So the first thing we have to do is identify that we have the right band in the room, because this is radio and not television, although we will put a picture up on the website later. So would you identify yourselves, please, in no order of appearance?
William.
I'm Kyle.
Caitlin. Collectively, we are known as Reiner Maria.
This whole DIY scene that you came from.
At the time, there was, Bill can probably offer some deeper background information on the state of Wisconsin itself, having grown up there, but at the time, not just in Madison, Wisconsin, but all over the U.S., there was a sort of, DIY scene of lots of shows happening in basements and living rooms and, VFW halls, et cetera, all ages, $5 kind of shows, like, everywhere, sort of the, Fugazi ethic kind of concept. I mean, I think here in the Bay Area, there was no exception. I think the Gilman Street Club or whatever that was sort of like, I don't think anybody had ever been or had any idea what it was, but we heard that it was really cool.
Was there drinking?
I don't know. Oh, you mean at our shows?
Was there any sort of alcohol, or drugs or anything?
Well, it depended really on where you were. At our shows, there was officially no drinking or drugging, although people told me later that they would go in the backyard and kind of hide behind a tree and do their thing and then come to the shows all messed up and try to, like, not let anyone know. But, it was more like, for us, it was more like, oh, let's buy a party ball of root beer and cook some food, kind of.
A party ball, that is so Wisconsin. A party ball, wow. I haven't heard the word party ball since party ball.
Since those speedballs.
Well, let's get serious. You had to bring it back there. I was teasing about the liquor and the drugs, because there is none of that in rock and roll ever.
It's true.
Ever. No payola, no liquor, no drugs. No promoters, no nothing.
No music.
No music, it's non-existent. But let's, all kidding aside, when you talk about the DIY ethic, why don't you really describe what it really meant and what it was all about?
Well, in the case of what we were doing, it was like we were part of this network of people who were setting up shows for each other's bands and, charging not very much money for a show. And then, if there were, 50 people at a show and we charged $5, that's $250. And we would take like $10 for the cost of the flyers and then give the rest of the money to the band. So it was sort of like very much, not a profit motive as much as a love of underground music that was motivating everyone's hard work. And I think that scene that we came out of doesn't really exist the same way anymore. I don't think it's gone sort of like more to like legitimate clubs and stuff. I don't get this, and it may be that I'm completely missing it, but I don't get the sense that a lot of people are touring the entire U.S. and hitting all the major cities and the secondary cities, playing in each other's living rooms or basements or kind of all ages spaces like this. It's an entirely different beast now.
Did you move to Brooklyn before or after Williamsburg and Dumbo and all these terrible neighborhoods became ultra cool?
What sparked our move to New York City had nothing to do with the music industry or like the quote-unquote scene that was there. But honestly, there wasn't a scene there when we moved there. My girlfriend at the time was transferring to go to fashion school there.
FIT?
FIT, yeah. Caitlin's family is from Connecticut, so she grew up there and wanted to be close to her family.
We're going to have her say Connecticut later, because there's a way you have to say Connecticut.
And Kyle's sister was going to Sarah Lawrence at the time. So once you hit about 23, 24 in a college town, which Madison is, you start to feel a little old. So we wanted to make a move, and New York was definitely, the place that was pulling all three of us in the same direction. When we moved to Brooklyn, because we had a couple of friends that lived there, a couple of old, very dear friends. And the music scene basically consisted of, 90s singer-songwriter type folks. There was no there was no Liars, there was no Interpol, there wasn't any of that when we moved in the summer of 99. That did started to happen, and some of our friends who are in bands moved in, and it was just kind of a network that grew. There were a few transplanted bands, but there are also a lot of people who were musicians that didn't have a band who started to move in, and people started to form bands. Then you get the AAS, you get the Liars, you get Interpol. Those are all people who, like us, have been playing music for years, but came from smaller towns like us in Madison, and they met in New York and were able to form these bands that they had always wanted to form.
Okay, you're a 10-year-old band, and you spent the last 3 years writing the new Catastrophe Keeps Us Together, and you did not, am I correct, have a label at the time? You didn't know where this was going to go, so you figured 3 years, and I want you to take this one, and we'll kind of spend some time on this record and make it what we really want it to be, right?
Yeah, I mean, we knew that these songs were special, but we, you know, had only played them as a three-piece in our practice space in the ultra-cool Williamsburg, of course, above North 6th, a really fantastic venue. But
it's a great club, yeah.
So we went with the producer, Peter Kadis. He was nearby, and also we really wanted to work with him on some rock music, and that was earlier in 2004. We recorded the first two songs on the record, actually. And yeah, I mean, many months later, we ended up with, you know, at Malcolm Burns' amazing studio home in Kingston, New York. So Peter's in Bridgeport, Connecticut, by the way.
Sexy places, Kingston, New York, and Bridgeport, Connecticut.
You can't beat them for sex.
So rock and roll.
Yeah.
You've just blown your whole rock and roll cover, you know that.
We stayed in these guys' houses and, you know, would roll out of bed in the morning and have our granola and yogurt or, you know, steak and eggs, whatever your choice was, and then just go into the living room or the attic and play music, which was a great way to play these songs, you know, more in a more, you know, realized setting, I guess, with other instruments, for instance, on some of them.
So what did you set out to make this band?
We were all, like, doing, you know, putting on shows for bands that were touring and coming through, and Kyle and I had been in, you know, a small punkish type band before, and we disbanded, and Kyle and I still wanted to play music, and we were good friends with Caitlin, and we're like, let's do it, you know? And it was more of a, not necessarily a hobby, because it was more than a hobby, because we're all very passionate about it. But it, in some ways, it was just a way to have a local band to open up for some of these touring acts to come through.
Good local band, as opposed to, we won't go there. We call them the singer-songwriter that knows how to play a Dylan song backwards, you know?
Yes, those aren't my words, okay?
No, those are my words.
All right.
No, I can do it. I'm responsible. I'm a responsible adult, right. Sort of.
Get out of my head, okay?
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, there were no aspirations of, you know, being able to do this at any point, you know, for a living or to do it professionally. It was something that, you know, we all had a passion for, and we all wanted to kind of be a part of in our own little niche, in our own little small college town.
You have anything to add to that story, Kyle, or shall I just go straight to Caitlin and ask her why she bothered?
I guess, like, it's funny. It was sort of, I mean, it never would have occurred to us. I mean, we were all really passionate music fans, and it just never would have occurred to us that being in a band was something that you couldn't or didn't do as, you know, if you loved music. I mean, I guess there are a lot of people who listen to music and are music fans and live and breathe and die for music, but that don't start bands. But I guess, but for the scene we were in, the community, really, that we were a part of at that time, like, it just wouldn't have made any sense to be, like, a non-participant observer. And so in that regard, like, that's what you did, and that's how you took part in the community, you know, and how you, like, made your mark. And everyone was, in a way, maybe because, you know, the internet, the advent of the internet hadn't really, the impact hadn't been felt the same way, like, there's still, like, sort of like a regional flavor to what we did, and there was, like, a sort of, like, the way that the things were put together, the chords, or the way the singing was done, there was, like, kind of a regional flavor to what was going on in Madison and Chicago and Milwaukee in there, you know, with, like, ourselves and the Promise Ring and Cap'n Jazz, or later Joan of Arc. Like, there was sort of, like, a real regional flavor that was an amazing thing to be a part of, to develop a kind of musical idiom, you know, together, like the way that in a group of friends you develop your own little slang and your inside jokes. It was kind of like that with music, and so it just seemed like the most natural thing in the world was to like speak that idiom, you know, with our friends, and which meant to start a band.
I was only marginally a part of this scene, this DIY scene in Madison. I had just come back from studying abroad for a year in London, and, you know, I had just come back, and, like, acid jazz was really big at the time, and so I had been going, I've always loved going to clubs and dancing, I've always loved music, I've always loved listening and going to see live shows, and it really was at a time in my life when I could, you know, I had all the elements that I could put together to transform my life and become, you know, an active singer-songwriter. So, you know, Kyle took me down to the basement.
Pregnant pause, ladies and gentlemen.
One day, because, you know, I told him, I just, and it was very clear I couldn't sing out. You know, I hadn't found my voice. So we went down there because we were going to be making a lot of noise, and we didn't want the neighbors. You know, it's Wisconsin, so.
Right.
You know, noise. Betty, carries or whatever, there, yeah. Right. And he just said, "Yell at me in my face," you know. And we, you know, at first it was just a little squeak like a mouse, and then it turned into more of a full-fledged thing. And so, you know, when we were practicing, then it suited me very well. We had no PA or whatever to project my voice, and as the years went by, it just kept growing stronger. And I mean, really, as a motivation, you know, I've just wanted to make things that make a sound. Write words and sing them in a way that sounds beautiful to me, like in a way that a band like Spiritualize or Spaceman 3 used to move me when I listened to it before I was a musician. So that was my motivation to do this, I think.
I don't know a lot about your label. So how did you get signed? And am I right that it's a brand new label?
We were their first signing. There's only been one other signing, which is the band Mohair from England. And Q Prime was basically, Grunion, there's a thing called Q Prime, which is a management company that manages Metallica and the Red Hot Chili Peppers and Shania Twain and Garbage, a few like great big giant acts, yeah. And they decided to start a record label, but they wanted to do work, at least start it on a smaller scale. They didn't have any, you know, they weren't trying to be like another Sony. It was like, no, we want to like build this tight thing that's based on like terrific music and so they hired an A&R person and sort of assembled like a rough staff and then started looking around for music and they got an early version of our record. There was an early one that circulated before we added Peter's two songs to it. And then when the Peter stuff got added a little while after that, I think all of a sudden the record and then subsequently our band started to make a lot of sense to them and eventually ended in our signing with them, which is I think fortuitous for all parties.
Interesting choice to cover Nico's version of a Bob Dylan song. And that's the way it's written up, is that you covered Nico's version of a Bob Dylan song as opposed to Bob Dylan's version of a Nico song, which I'd really like to hear.
I had bought a copy of Chelsea Girls while we were on tour maybe like 4 or 5 years ago. And, you know, I put it in that day and I'm like, you know, I'd been a fan of the song for a long time and I don't know if Kyle and Caitlin had heard the song before, and it was always a song that not only did it appeal to me, but it as like a musician, but it appealed to me on a different level, a level that it was coming from the same spot in my head when I write a song. That's where that song was coming from, something from like a more than it purely intellectual, almost like a spiritual thing. It's like, okay, this is like the music that I write. You know, I would write a song like this, and I never feel about that, about music at all. And I put it on, and Caitlin, within 5 seconds of putting it on, Caitlin said, you know, this is an amazing song. This is something we should cover. And, you know, Kyle felt the same way. So it was the first time that all three of us had agreed on a song to cover. We had never really thought of doing that before. And as far as the recording goes, again, we were just, it was very kind of not thrown together, but we just sat down and we were gonna like, we talked to Malcolm about it and we ran through it, you know, with in a rock kind of setting, guitar, bass, drums, and it wasn't so happening. Malcolm was like, you know, I've worked with Bob Dylan before, this is great what you're doing, but I think maybe a different vibe might suit the song a little bit better. So we just sat down and he handed me a hand drum and Caitlin a microphone and, you know, Kyle a guitar, and he's like, Kyle can tell the story much better than I of like what he went through with the guitar and like all the settings. And we ran it like maybe a half dozen times and he said, okay, that was amazing, that's it.
Distinctive differences between the two for me vocally and was that Peter was trying to get the most beautiful, lush, honey sounded, you know, performance of vocals. Malcolm would have me sit in a rickety old wooden chair right next to him at the console and sing through maybe a mic that wasn't so great, and he was all about the intimacy of a moment, of a performance. So it really, you know, what I learned from both of those great producers was that you really, you know, you can get such a different sound, you know, such a different feeling from I think maybe what I said was very obvious how I distinguished the two, actually. I can't even wrap it up with something that sounds as, you know, interesting to me as, like, just remembering the experience of singing with the two of them.
You have 19,281 friends on MySpace. And while my usual question is how many you know and who your favorite is, but I thought it was more interesting that your number one and number two friends are the bands you're touring with, which I thought was very, very classy of you. And then secondly, in your top 10 is A.L. Scott, the film critic for the New York Times. That's a very, if you're going to pick a friend to have in your top 10, you didn't pick, you know, like the babe and the male babe, because everybody always has like a stripper or something in there. How on rock and roll of you to put A.O. Scott in there?
I think when we're not on tour, I'm always the one that chooses the top 8 friends. I'm letting out a little secret here, but when we're not on tour, I usually just scroll through all the pages and find, you know, pick a theme and then choose friends based on that theme.
Oh, funny.
At one time I had like all moving, you know, images and maybe all black and white.
You're actually using MySpace as an art form.
Well, I mean, you know, seriously. Otherwise it's just boring. So, but yeah, since we've been on tour, I've kind of just, that has fallen off a little bit because I do want to have the bands we're touring with up there. So when we're finished with tour, we'll see. Maybe we'll go back to more New York Times critics or something. We'll see. I don't know.
So what country are you big in and what country would you like to be massively huge in?
Where were all those inquiries from? Malaysia? Weren't there like a whole bunch of inquiries from Malaysia last year?
Malaysia. I would have died. Why do they say catastrophe in Malaysian?
Yeah.
I don't know.
The Philippines?
Yeah.
Philippines.
Germany. Japan's big.
Jakarta. Kuala Lumpur. Throughout Indonesia.
This is not Warp Tour territory.
No, it's not.
I found a great quote from the namesake for the band. Works of art are indeed always products of having been in danger, of having gone to the very end in an experience to know where no man can go no further.
It was like both at the ends, I mean, all the way to the limits of our creative capacity and even to a certain extent our physical capacity, you know, in terms
you
of like...
You had it.
Yeah, we had all slaved over, you know, mixes and artwork and photos and you name it, you know, like it was just like,
you're like
all the way to the end.
You already enough.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, wait, this DIY thing was a really poor idea in the final analysis. Not really, but I just mean like we poured so much of ourselves into it that it may be that Herr Rilke is indeed correct in this case. Okay, hello.
So the last thing we do, we call it a musical sandwich. And what we do is we take two of your songs as the bread. And the fillings are anything by any other artist.
We'll do Burn and Life of Leisure off the new record and take it from there.
Got it.
Kiss Them for Me, Susie and the Banshees.
The Slide Song by Spiritualized.
Devil Got My Woman, 1966 version from the album of the same name by Skip James.
I love your Skip James.
Do the Do by A Certain Ratio.
I've Lived on a Dirt Road All My Life by Manitoba.
I Loves You Porgy, the Nina Simone version.
Continuous Hit Music by the American Analog Set.
Cloud Bursting by Kate Bush.
Mountain Song by Jane's Addiction.
How about Birthday by the Sugar Cubes?
Lovely.
Oh, what's that song by the Sundays that we... Modern Life?
Oh, I can't be sure what I want anymore, but it'll what's come it to me later. I think it's Can't Be Sure.
Can't Be Sure.